And as we watch the developments in Egypt, we are also marking the 237th birthday of our own country. On July 4th, 1776, the Continental Congress approved the final version of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson's document that declared the colonies free of British rule. The declaration was, of course, a crucial moment, but it was really just one scene in a drama that played out over several months before and after that momentous event in Philadelphia. That drama plays out in a new book by historian Joseph Ellis. It is called Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence, and Joseph Ellis joins us now from WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Professor Ellis, welcome.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. And these characters and the territory that you cover in this book have been written about a lot by a lot of people. So I'm wondering first if you could just tell us, what are you trying to do here that hasn't been done?
One of the things that I found that isn't part of the normal story is that two things were going on at the same time in the summer of 76. There's the political story happening in Philadelphia and the Continental Congress, ending with the Declaration. And then there's the military story going on down in New York, in which the Continental Army is about to face off against a British force of 42,000 soldiers and sailors, the largest amphibious force ever to cross the Atlantic. You have to put those two stories together to understand the chemistry of the moment, and that really the consensus for American independence only took shape once the colonists realized they were being invaded. It wasn't a constitutional issue anymore. It was a military issue.
And I want to talk about that, but another thing that's very interesting about this, and the title of the book is Revolutionary Summer. I mean, I think we think about the revolution as a long process, but it's amazing how much happened just in a short period of time.
Yeah, this is the crescendo moment in which they make the decision for independence. They commit themselves to go to war with the British Army in a full way. They've been pretending the war didn't exist, but in fact, people should remember, the war really has been going on for 15 months. It's 15 months between Lexington Concord and the July Declaration. Not only that politically, but militarily, the things that happen in the summer of 76 create the framework for the rest of the whole war, and how it's going to be fought, and indeed, in some sense, what the outcome is going to be.
Well, what did you find in your research was more important here, what was happening on the political side or what was happening on the military side? Could either have survived without the other?
No, they're totally equal and reinforcing. Up until late spring and early summer of 76, a majority of delegates in the Continental Congress and, the best we can know, people out in the countryside were committed to opposing British right of taxation and legislation, but they weren't committed to secession from the British Empire. What changes people's minds in the May and June and July of 76 is this huge invasion force, and that the British have decided that they're not going to end this diplomatically. There was a diplomatic solution to this, but that they're going to quash this thing because it's an early version of the domino theory. If we let the colonists get away with what they want to get away with, what's going to happen in Scotland? What's going to happen in Ireland? What's going to happen in India? Plus, we have the military resources, the best combination army and navy in the world, to quash this thing in the cradle. Yet that very decision is what galvanizes popular opinion for independence.
And everyone on both sides of the Atlantic understood the value and importance of New York. Talk about that, which culminated, of course, in a battle.
Yeah, New York is the major port, and the British want to get it so that their navy can have a base. But not only that, there's a plan put together by the equivalent of the British Secretary of War, Lord George Germain. He's going to send over the largest amphibious force ever to cross the Atlantic. The next time a force this big goes across the Atlantic is during World War I.
Hmm.
We're going to take New York, and the two British commanders, their brothers, the Howe brothers, Richard the Admiral and William the General, are going to then, once established in New York, move up the Hudson, meeting a British army coming down from the Hudson, and seal off New England, which is the cradle of the rebellion, and then march across New England and put down all of the insurrection and end it then and there. It's a pretty good plan. They never are allowed to implement it fully, but it's their way of trying to recognize that they have to end this insurgency fast. If it's a protracted war, it's going to be difficult to win.
Did the political leaders on this side of the Atlantic realize what they were up against there?
Yes, but with a certain qualification. There is a profound awareness on the part of many delegates, especially those who are reluctant revolutionaries, that this might very well be a suicidal act. And Jefferson's words in the Declaration, "Our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor," were not rhetoric. They realized they were risking everything. But there was a recognition on the part of some of them, especially people like John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, that it wasn't going to be a war between armies. It was going to be a war in which the British had to subjugate the entire American populace. And I think our own experience in Southeast Asia and later in the Middle East makes us more aware of the problem that the British were going to face in trying to squash this rebellion. And so they had to win it quickly. And if they didn't, it would start to drain on them, and it would end up being a war that was going to be difficult for them to win.
And they didn't. So why didn't they? What did they do wrong?
What they did wrong is not end it quickly. And they had a chance on Long Island and Manhattan, did the Howe brothers, to annihilate the Continental Army. They have the opportunity to do that, but they don't want to do it. They are people who think this war is misguided. They've come to deliver a stunning but proportional blow and then hope that the Americans will come to their senses and negotiate a peace. That's their real goal, to try to deliver a stunning blow and then serve as peace brokers. But as a result, they missed the one chance to win the war.
That's Joseph Ellis, a professor of history emeritus at Mount Holyoke College. His new book is called Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. And when we come back, we will talk about some of the characters of the revolution.
Look forward to that. And to All Things Considered later today, quick note, they'll have the story of Texas Senator Ted Cruz, the son of a Cuban refugee, but his hardline stance on immigration has alienated Latinos. That's later today. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, protecting drivers and their families with insurance coverage for over 75 years. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
Welcome back to our conversation with historian Joseph Ellis about his new book, Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. It traces the political and military events of the summer of 1776. Now, there was, of course, the Declaration of Independence, but it was also the summer when a huge British force trapped the Continental Army at New York, then let them slip away, missing, as Professor Ellis said before the break, their chance to win the war. And Professor Ellis, I want to talk to you about some of the characters here, starting with John Adams, who many Americans know a lot about, especially after David McCullough's famous book and the HBO series. But what I learned about him in your book is that he is kind of the guy who just wants to make this happen, even if he has to make sacrifices to do so.
Yeah, he's the radical in Congress in the 74-75 and early 76, when the vast majority of people are moderates. They're searching for a way out of this. Adams basically says they're searching for a messiah that will never come. He knows before anybody else that this is not going to end peacefully, and he's committed to pushing that agenda. He makes him unpopular in the Congress. He says he makes himself obnoxious because he keeps telling them that it's not going to work as the way they want to, and he keeps being right. This is really his finest hour. He later goes on to be vice president and president of the United States. But this is the hour he is the man on the spot in the most important moment in American history, and he's the guy who pushes for independence. Then he's made Secretary of War and Ordnance in June of 76, the equivalent of Secretary of Defense, and he says, "I'm not qualified for this job," and he writes to his friends in Cambridge and asks them to take out all the books at the Harvard Library on how to run an army. But for the next year and a half, he's in charge of military policy. So he is probably the key player on the political side during this period.
What about Benjamin Franklin? He, on the other hand, came a bit reluctantly to the cause. He was not as adamant about breaking away from the British Empire.
He had been spending the last 20 years of his life in London. He was an American agent in London for this colony of Pennsylvania, and so he's not aware of the degree of grievance in the colonies towards the taxation policies of Parliament. He's got a son who's actually a loyalist governor of New Jersey, but though he's late to the game, he comes back to America and immediately assumes a leadership position. And he's the sort of grandfather amongst the fathers. He's the most famous American of his time, especially abroad, because of his role as a scientist as well as a statesman. And she immediately elected to the Congress and becomes one of the major figures.
And then there is someone who does not have near the name recognition of John Adams or Benjamin Franklin, and that is John Dickinson. Tell us about him and the role he played.
Dickinson, at the time, was regarded as perhaps the single most prominent figure in the Continental Congress because he spoke for the majority position, which was the moderate position. He believed that the American position constitutionally, that Parliament had no right to legislate or tax, was right, but that there had to be a diplomatic way to avoid a break in the empire because any war with Great Britain was going to be ruinous for both America and Britain. He's a Quaker. He's married to a Quaker woman. He's a pacifist, though eventually he serves in the militia himself. And he's regarded as one of the leading spokesmen for a position that up until the late spring of 76 is the majority position. He's undone by the fact that George III simply decides he's going to make this a war.
Now, there's a question that comes up over and over again when we look back on this history. Why didn't the founding fathers acknowledge slavery when they fought for independence? Because it so obviously violates the principles they were fighting for.
They knew that. That is to say, even Southern planters like Jefferson and Washington were aware of the fact that the principles on which the Revolution was based were incompatible with slavery. And yet, slavery was embedded in the economy of states south of the Chesapeake and of south of the Potomac, I guess, and in a way that made it very difficult to end it easily. And whenever it came up, and it came up for the first time in June of 76, when they're debating what kind of government they want to have after they are independent, they can't address slavery directly. It's so volatile and toxic an issue, explosive an issue, that if they address it directly, it's going to blow the whole independence movement up. And once it comes up explicitly, South Carolina says, if you have to talk about slavery, we're seceding. Hmm. That isn't, you're not going to get a union. You're not going to get a unanimous vote on independence. Georgia would have probably gone the same way. The same thing is going to happen in the Constitutional Convention, 1787. So that slavery, on the one hand, is morally reprehensible. On the other hand, it's politically impossible to talk about it because you won't get an independent, you won't get a consensus on independence if you insist on putting it on the agenda.
Did that surprise you when you were doing your research about that, the big picture, if you will, was being overshadowed by what they needed economically to keep their states going?
No, I've seen this before, but it's dramatic here. And Adams, who is a Northerner, never owned a slave, opposed to slavery, writes the Massachusetts Constitution that eventually is the document that makes slavery illegal in Massachusetts. But he's the one that insists, do not bring it up. It is a deal breaker. And you can argue that justice delayed is justice denied, but Adams is a person who thinks that the key item at this moment on the political agenda is consensus on the question of independence. And if you destroy the independence consensus, then you don't have a republic that can make rulings on slavery later in the day.
So in the end, Joseph Ellis, as you look back on this period in history, which is something you've spent your career doing, what is your message? What should Americans be thinking about on this 4th of July, 2013?
Well, I think if you go back and try to immerse yourself, as I did, in the data of the summer of 76, the extraordinarily dramatic and almost improvisational character of the way it played out, recovering not the inevitability of it, but the problematic character of it. But also the magic words of American history are penned then, and I think that amidst our barbecues and our fireworks, maybe trying to decide what we think those words mean for us now, and what they meant then was a little different, but those are the magic words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Lincoln thought those words were incompatible with slavery. The women's movement thought they were incompatible with sexual inequality. Martin Luther King thought they were incompatible with segregation. And I think the question for us is whether they're incompatible with discrimination against gays.
Joseph Ellis, his new book is Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Professor Ellis, thank you so much for speaking with us and happy 4th of July.
Thanks for having me.
And a lot to think about there. But one footnote to all this, Robin, we're celebrating the 4th of July today, of course. But John Adams actually thought July 2nd should be the big day. That was the day the Continental Congress resolved that the colony should be free.
Well, here is a letter that Adams wrote to his wife, Abigail. It's read by Peter Drummy of the Massachusetts Historical Society.
It ought to be commemorated with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other forevermore.
Well, he didn't get the day right, but he got the look just fine.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Bicon, providing the Bicon Dental Implant System, a comprehensive short dental implant solution since 1985. Details at Bicon.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross Radio Line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Best Buy.